Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda, I like guns, I hate guns, I like abortion, I hate abortion, and walk in like a royal queen and impose, you know, their will on the world.
What impact will the new Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett have on healthcare, civil rights, and abortion rights? I asked pro-life activists who support her nomination. And I asked legal expert Dahlia Lithwick about originalism, textualism, and what all this means for democracy itself. Then, novelist Dave Eggers on how he thinks his Trumpian satire has held up since it was first published a year ago. Plus,
she wasn't going to let him batter my soul in the same way that he was battering hers.
Domestic abuse rises to shocking levels under cover of COVID. Our Michelle Martin speaks to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Natasha Trethewey about her new memoir, Memorial Drive. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. It is day two of confirmation hearings in the United States for Amy Coney Barrett. She's President Trump's third Supreme Court appointment. And the stake could not be higher, with health care amid this pandemic top of mind on both sides of the Atlantic. In yet another case of politics versus science, here in Britain, a bombshell revelation that the government of Boris Johnson rejected advice from its own scientific advisers in September to implement a short lockdown as cases dangerously rose. And they continue to rise across the United States as senators question Judge Barrett's interpretation of the law amid concerns about her faith and previously stated opinions. Familiar battle lines are drawn between Republicans and Democrats, from the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare to abortion and civil rights. Judge Barrett claims personal faith should not interfere with court rulings. But what do pro-life activists make of her nomination? My first guest tonight is one of them. Jessica Anderson is executive director of Heritage Action for America, lobbying for conservative policies on Capitol Hill. And she's joining us now from Washington. Jessica Anderson, welcome to the program. So you've been watching clearly very closely the Senate questioning of Judge Barrett. What exactly, if you can sum it up, is your case for her to be the next Supreme Court justice?
Thank you for having me. Judge Barrett is an exceptional judge. She has incredible jurisprudence, an originalist perspective in all of her legal writings, and we're excited to see her move through the Senate judiciary process this week and ultimately to the Senate floor. We think she's a great nominee. She's a great legal scholar, and she will bring a certain sense of decorum to the Supreme Court in filling that ninth seat, hopefully sooner rather than later.
You've seen some really interesting presentations from various senators. Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democratic senator from Rhode Island, just a few minutes ago, brought up some pretty interesting evidence, reports, and things that he had taken down from the Republican platform, including this from one of the other pro-life groups in Washington, which is the Susan B. Anthony Foundation. Let's just play what he's raised in the Senate, and then we'll talk to you about it.
The Susan B. Anthony Foundation is running advertisements right now saying that you are set. You are set to give our pro-life country
the court that it deserves.
There's the ad with the voiceover. She's set. She's set.
So, Jessica Anderson, clearly that's what your group wants as well. Give me an idea. Do you expect that to be one of her signature, achievements on the court?
Well, I think there is something to clear up here. Of course, I have a personal opinion on Roe v. Wade, as does Judge Barrett. She is acknowledged as such. But I really do think it's a bit unfair to stake out the potential position of a judge before a case is in front of them. So some of the Democrat comments today and yesterday around how she may or may not rule on the ACA or Obamacare, or Roe v. Wade, or Heller and the gun cases, they all really are premature. And just like previous judicial nominations that have come before the committee and the full Senate, we don't yet know how they will rule if a case, in fact, it heads in front of them at the Supreme Court. So my organization, we view the role of the judiciary differently. We view it as a way to protect the Constitution, to protect the rule of law. I think many Democrats view it as a super legislator in some places where they can enact policies that they may or may not be able to push through Congress or the White House at another given time.
I agree with you. We don't yet know how a Supreme Court justice would cast an important vote. However, when you say it's premature to judge, let me just read you this. You must know this, obviously, that she signed her name, Judge Barrett, to a newspaper ad in 2006, you know, that's a long time ago, that denounced the, quote, barbaric legacy of Roe versus Wade and called for it to be overturned. She was a member of Faculty for Life as a law professor at Notre Dame University, where she got her law degree. And today, under questioning from Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, she also asked particularly about the Affordable Care Act and about Roe versus Wade. Here's the exchange.
Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe was wrongly decided?
If I express a view on a precedent one way or another, whether I say I love it or I hate it, it signals to litigants that I might tilt one way or another in a pending case.
Let me try again. Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe was wrongly decided?
Senator, I completely understand why you are asking the question, but again, I can't pre-commit or say, yes, I'm going in with some agenda because I'm not. I don't have any agenda. I have no agenda to try to overrule Casey. I have an agenda to stick to the rule of law and decide cases as they come.
So she referred to Casey there just for our viewers. It's a 1992 ruling that upheld Roe versus Wade and reaffirmed it. I mean, that's a non-answer answer. Again, what, you know, your groups have spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of money, and a lot of strategic planning for decades to try to overturn Roe versus Wade. Are you really saying now that that's actually not your agenda? What is the agenda then on Roe versus Wade?
Well, we've spent a lot of time and money and effort to have an originalist put on the bench. I mean, that really becomes the heart of this issue, whether or not she is an originalist and whether or not we can count on her to do that. I will just say her comments today, I think that was a good clip to play, but also her remarks yesterday, which is that she's articulating there is a difference between her personal view on a subject, which is why she signed that letter that has been referenced, and then how she might rule as a judge. And a number of senators went through every single policy position that, you know, is under the sun right now to ask, can you separate your personal opinion from a potential Supreme Court case in front of you? And I think her words and her commitment to the American people that she would do so is important. And it's one that we should take her at her word for and use this process through the judiciary to fine tune that and to better understand her jurisprudence as opposed to any personal policy positions.
Okay, so that might, in fact, end up happening, but you know better than I do that the 2016, which is the 2020 GOP platform, and we've heard from President Trump himself and many of his supporters and those of you in the anti-abortion movement, pro-life movement, have said that that's what you want to see, an overturning of Roe versus Wade, the Gay Marriage Act, and also parts of Obamacare. So let me just put it to you again. As you know, some 6 in 10 American people say the Supreme Court should uphold Roe versus Wade. But the numbers that are truly fascinating to me are the numbers in the latest Washington Post poll, which suggests that even amongst evangelicals, there is a majority that agree. Listen to this. White evangelical Protestants overall, not just those who lean Republican, are split, with 44% saying Roe should be overturned and 41% saying it should be upheld. So that's very close. A 60% majority of Catholics and 62% of white Catholics say Roe should be upheld. Who are you doing this for, then? What is the democratic imperative of this kind of agenda if it's not for the American people? I'm not sure where you and your groups are headed if the American people are clear about wanting, by a majority, Roe versus Wade to be upheld. And we've seen what they want about Obamacare, and we've seen the Supreme Court rulings on that so far.
Well, look, I'm personally pro-life. The organization that I work for, Heritage Action, we advocate pro-life positions here in Washington. But when it comes to judges and the judicial process, we are very clear. We want to see an originalist on the bench, and we want to see that filled with this ninth seat. So to me, anytime that you rely on the judiciary to advance a policy position, that's out of step with not only what the American people want, as you've just described, but also our American founding. And so we have no desire to see the judiciary turned into a super legislature. I think Congress has their hands full enacting policies. Obviously, the Trump administration has done a lot on the pro-life cause, including defunding much of Planned Parenthood and providing the Protect Life rule. I mean, this is the type of work that we can get excited about because it puts the arguments around the abortion fight and the life fight back into the hands of legislatures and out of the courts. So we actually fall specifically in supporting an originalist, and that really is why I'm excited about Judge Barrett moving through the process this week.
I wonder whether you're convinced, though, that legislatures, by a huge majority in the United States, would heavily restrict Roe, because I say, you know, they were moving certainly at the time in a much more reform way, and the democratic will of the people is clear with all these numbers that I have read to you. But I also wonder what you think about your organization, as I mentioned, Susan B. Anthony, other organizations which are like-minded. What you think then about President Trump, because, for instance, in an interview with the New York Times, Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony, said she didn't support Trump initially, but he's been the most pro-life president in history. He's appointed more than 200 judges, and now he's had three Supreme Court justices. Is that the legacy that you are looking for? Let's say he doesn't win in November. Let's say there's a, you know, Democratic Congress elect. Let's just say, is the Supreme Court then the legacy that you're looking for? And are some of President Trump's, you know, questions about his moral compass, about his behavior over the last 3 years, a worthwhile trade-off?
Well, look, I am going to judge President Trump's administration and his legacy based on the policies that he puts in place for the American people. And I think that runs the gamut from economic issues and international issues to, of course, life issues, as we're talking about now. And so, you know, when I look at President Trump's nominees, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and now Barrett, I'm looking specifically through the lens of, are they an originalist? Will they uphold the Constitution and the rule of law when it's applied to the cases that are before them today? If President Trump's nominees prove true to that, then I think that is a lasting legacy. It's one that restores the rule of law in many ways to the Supreme Court and takes it out of this partisan politics that are taking place and frankly, that hurt the country when it becomes so embroiled in the partisanship that we're not able to see past each other as just Americans. So I'm looking forward to Judge Barrett on the court because I actually think she will turn the temperature down in this country and allow a shift that's going to hopefully be generational. I mean, she's very young. She has the potential to be on here for three, you know, maybe four decades, maybe not that long, but long enough for there to truly be a generational shift where we can get some of this partisanship around policymaking out of the courts, back to the legislature, whether that's here in Congress in Washington or at the state level, and not rely on judges to advance policy positions on either side of the aisle.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about originalism with our next guest, but I want to ask you finally, again, people in America have said exactly what they mean, and they've been saying it since 1972 when Roe versus Wade was adjudicated. The majority of American people, by a fairly healthy majority, want to keep it and do not want to see it overturned. Now, I want to ask you about this because it's got a related aspect. President Trump, as you know, apparently feeling much better after his bout with COVID, after being hospitalized, but trumpeted over and over again what he said was the main, at least he felt, the main drug that made him feel so much better, Regeneron, which is a monoclonal antibody serum. Now, as you know, it was derived and developed using human cells derived from a fetus that was aborted decades ago. President Trump called this a cure. What do you make of that?
Well, I think going back to your first point, there's an argument that can be made as the American people have weighed in through polling and obviously through letters to the editor and campaigns at the local level, then let's allow any sort of policy legislation that needs to go forward on abortion to be handled at the state level. And I think the great makeup that we have in this country around federalism will allow that to happen. And you see states having everything from, you know, the 24-hour notifying period to parental rights, all of that playing out at the state level, which is an important, I think, element in this conversation. As to the president's well-being, and as he clearly has turned the corner, thankfully, from his bout with COVID over the last week, you know, I can't speak to any specifics on a drug that of how it was made or the specifics of how it's helped him. But I think at the end of the day, what you're seeing from President Trump is that he listened to his doctors. His doctors advised him to move to the hospital, to leave the Oval Office. He followed that advice. He's thankfully feeling better. And we would hope the same for any of our elected officials, as well as all Americans that might be stricken ill from COVID-19.
Everybody wishes everybody well, of course, but President Trump has talked over and over again about the issues we're talking about tonight, today. The New York Times has quoted a doctor who led the International Society for Stem Cell Research saying, if they oppose this research, they should be willing not to take a drug that was developed using that. Do you agree? Is it not somewhat hypocritical?
Well, again, I can't speak to the drugs that the president's doctors...
Anybody, yourself, would you take it? Would you take Regeneron?
I personally would have to look and see if that was something that my doctor was prescribing, if it was meant to help me feel better. And then at the end of the day, I think that decision is between the individual and their doctor in their healthcare choice. And that's what all the conversation around healthcare reform and healthcare freedom really comes down to. Access to care and making that decision to be as small of a circle of people as possible between the doctor and the individual.
Right. It goes to the heart of abortion, though, and to the heart of the pro-life issue. And, of course, the argument for Roe versus Wade is precisely what you say, the freedom for individuals to make decisions over their own bodies. So, finally, do women have the right to make their own decisions in the most intimate and sometimes painful, often painful, situations?
Women have the right to make decisions over their health care, but they don't have the right to take away the decision of a human being that's in their womb's health care. That's really what this comes down to. Do you believe that life begins at conception and that is a child in utero developing? And I think at the end of the day, the more the extremism of abortion comes to light with late-term abortions and even abortions after the woman has survived an abortion, then what do you do with the baby, whether you call it infanticide or you keep them comfortable? That's the kind of stuff that I look at. And I believe that along with the majority of Americans, that that's too far. And it represents a shift in our culture as we look at this important issue. And ultimately, as it plays out at the state level, as it plays out with state regulations and state legislatures, and hopefully it doesn't distract us too much from Judge Barrett's confirmation process as she moves through the Supreme Court this week.
Jessica Anderson, thank you for joining us. Now, listening to all of this is Dahlia Lithwick. She is Slate's legal correspondent, and in her latest jurisprudence column, she warns that these confirmation hearings represent, quote, the erosion of representative democracy in the United States. That is pretty dramatic, and Dahlia Lithwick is joining us from Ontario, Canada. Welcome to the program. I wonder if you could just weigh in there. Is there a mix of morality going on when it comes to using drugs that are derived from stem cells that pro-life, candidates disapprove of? And the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, which is all about the pro-life agenda?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. And I think you're exactly right. I think you can't say, you know, what sauce for the goose isn't sauce for the gander if you are opposed to all of this stem cell research. If you say fundamentally this is immoral, then you can't turn around and reap the benefits of using it as medicine when you're in a crunch. I will say, I just think we get very, very, very knocked off course, Christiane, when we start talking about infanticide and late-term abortions. I mean, I think we have to be really, really focused on what the terms of this conversation are. Infanticide is not part of this conversation.
Well indeed, the majority of Americans, as I said, approve of upholding Roe, but with some restrictions. So I think that's also interesting as well. But I want to ask you, because Jessica Anderson spoke over and over again about this concept of originalism. Can you tell us what she means precisely in relation to this nominee and the questions that she's being asked?
Yeah, originalism is a method of constitutional interpretation. It's a toolbox. It was probably most famously embodied by Justice Antonin Scalia. That's Amy Coney Barrett's mentor. She clerked for him. And I think there's different flavors of it, but the flavor that Judge Barrett says she subscribes to is this notion that when you look at either a constitutional provision or a statutory provision, you go back and you try to figure out what was the original public meaning that the drafter had in mind. In other words, you don't triangulate forward into the future. You don't necessarily look at present circumstances. You are very much bound by the actual language of the statute or the provision. Whatever the drafters thought it meant is what it means. And that means sometimes looking in dictionaries, contemporaneous dictionaries, but it's a way of saying I'm constrained by the language of the law.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, anybody who's read history knows that the framers themselves were bitterly divided, and had lots of disputes over the actual, you know, meaning of the document. I guess it's just an obvious question, and it's hard to understand how one would expect a 21st century judge or a 21st century Supreme Court being bound by a text that was as brilliant as it was hundreds of years ago. How is that possible? I mean, does that happen elsewhere?
Well, it's not clear that it's possible. I think the effort is to try as best you can to replicate it. But you're quite right. Senator Dick Durbin today was pressing Judge Barrett on how you think about the Second Amendment and original public meaning when folks had muskets, not weapons of war. So there's one problem, which is, how do you understand, you know, stem cell research? How do you understand marriage equality? How do you understand so many complexities of campaign finance through the lens of the Constitution? There's a second problem. I think it's more pressing, and that is there are a lot of provisions of the Constitution, like due process, equal protection of the law, that had no meaning. They were deliberately left broad in order to pour future meanings into it. And so I think that while it's nice to say as a sort of rhetorical trick that the framers had the answers to everything, the framers were smart enough to say on some questions, what is cruel and unusual punishment, we're going to leave that open so that each generation can interpret it as that generation sees fit. So there's a lot of limitations on how far originalism, strictly construed, can get you.
Do you think, I mean, I read out to Jessica Anderson something that Judge Barrett had written when she was at Notre Dame about Roe versus Wade, and you saw that she didn't fully answer Senator Feinstein on the issue. Do you believe that that is her intention, or might she be a surprise? Do you think she might not vote to overturn Roe? What is your prognostication for what will happen to this particular law under the new Supreme Court if she's appointed?
A couple of answers. One, I noticed that Jessica Anderson confined herself to answering in terms of Judge Barrett's speeches and writings and the ads she signed. But we actually have evidence from Judge Barrett's time on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. She actually weighed in on abortion cases. So we know how she thinks of this, not just as a citizen, but as a judge. And in two cases that I could come up with, she went much further than any normal judge looking at precedent would go. In other words, she was willing to push beyond Roe, and I think that's emblematic. I also think we just have to take very seriously, and you brought this up, that Donald Trump has pledged to put someone on the court who will automatically overturn Roe. Josh Hawley has said he will not vote to confirm anyone who will not vote to overturn Roe. And so, in some sense, whether or not she wants to be bound by the promises that other people, including groups that say we will only support her if she strikes down Roe, she is bound by the fact that everyone else says they are pledging her to this. And so I think it puts Judge Barrett in a box, but I'm not sure it's a box she gets out of by simply saying, I'm a brain in a vat, I start from scratch, I have no prior opinions.
Interesting. In 2016 at Jacksonville University, she said she didn't think abortion or the right to abortion would change, but that, quote, some of the restrictions would change, and that the question is how much freedom the court is willing to let states have in regulating abortion. How do you see, you heard also Jessica Anderson talking about it going to the states. Where are the states right now? I mean, I know you can't say they're not all the same, but in general, what would you predict?
It depends on the state. We have states like Virginia and California that are making it ever easier through telemedicine and medication abortions for women to terminate pregnancies. We also have a whole host of red states that have tried very hard and largely succeeded in regulating all but one clinic out of existence. And so we have states like Louisiana that are down to almost no clinics to serve entire populations. So I think when you say, oh, this will just get kicked back to the states, what you're doing is consigning women in states like Texas or Louisiana or Ohio or Georgia to having no clinics. And what that means, of course, is that that will fall hardest on poor women and women of color who can't necessarily make their way to California. But I think the other thing that you say that's really important is that you don't have to write the words Roe v. Wade is overturned in order to end Roe just by regulating, and further regulating clinics until they go out of business. That's been kind of the playbook in a lot of red states. That will be the playbook that the Supreme Court, without ever saying Roe is formally overturned, just to create so many burdens on women seeking abortions and saying every one of those burdens is constitutional, that's probably the way the court will go.
So to state the obvious, we're in the middle of an election. This is a pretty controversial time to be, as the others have said, the critics ramming through such an important confirmation. And Democrats are trying to see and trying to get her to say that she will recuse herself from cases which could influence the election, California versus Texas, or any contest where voting rights could arise. This is what she said about it today.
I want to begin by making two very important points, and they have to do with the ACA and with any election dispute that may or may not arise. I have had no conversation with the president or any of his staff on how I might rule in that case. It would be a gross violation of judicial independence for me to make any such commitment or for me to be asked about that case and how I would rule.
How do you interpret what she said, and should she recuse herself given what the president has said about these issues?
This is a bit the point I was making before about how the president puts her in a box. Because the president has said, I need her on the court to strike down the ACA, I need her on the court to eviscerate Roe, I need her on the court, he said, to count ballots for me in a close election. It doesn't matter whether she pledged to the president or someone in the White House that she would do those things. The judicial recusal rules are really clear. Judges recuse if there's an appearance of bias or impropriety. And so what she's trying to do is disaggregate to say, well, I didn't make any promises. The fact that the president says she's made promises, that Josh Hawley has said she's made promises, the fact that Republican senators want her because they believe that she's going to put a thumb on the scale, puts her in the box of it looks improper. That's the benchmark for judges, not whether they actually do something biased, whether it looks biased. And that's a real problem that Donald Trump set up for her when he made all those promises in advance.
And in one word, in her 3 years on the appeals court, has she been apolitical?
I think she's been very much a card-carrying, originalist, Federalist Society conservative judge. She has not hidden who she is. We should take her at her word.
Dahlia Lithwick, thank you so much for joining us. And this all adds to the turbulence of the current presidency amid a tight election campaign. Writers, commentators, satirists, journalists and the like have grappled over the years with how best to cover this most unusual White House. Dave Eggers is, of course, known for his parable-like novels on important issues from globalization to technology and political polarization. In his novella, The Captain and the Glory, he follows the election of a large and lumpy man with a yellow feather in his hair, whose penchant for disruption has unintended consequences. Sound familiar? Well, Dave Eggers joins us from San Francisco. Welcome back to the program. Just having read and reread this book, it just seems that you kind of got it right. You figured out how to make a parable. And I just wonder what you were trying to do when you wrote it. Of course, it came out a year ago. Tell me what was the sort of impetus for when you wrote it.
It was pure self-therapy and telling myself a story that to make sense of this time. And I'd been going to Trump rallies since he was a candidate, and then watched with astonishment and horror when he got elected. And I guess I wanted to write a story that had an ending to this time, and parable or allegory gives you the chance to make sense of a complicated or chaotic time and sort of attach a linear narrative to it. And so for me, it was very cathartic and therapeutic, especially when I got to finish the story and imagine a time when we were free of this. We'd gone through this dark corridor and come out the other side.
Well, look, just to quote, your captain has a yellow feather in his hair. The captain is inspired by pirates. The pale one, maybe that was Putin. Blood beard, maybe that was MBS. I mean, you've certainly written about that. What you were digging in, it seems, also was a sort of a sense of inadequacy and insignificance. The captain sort of tosses books and experts overboard so that he doesn't feel inferior. What were you saying?
Well, I think Trump is surely the most fearful and insecure president we've had in the modern era. I think he is the most needy and the most desperate for approval and attention. And for whatever reason, that approval he seeks most of all is from other autocrats. And so the Captain and the Glory takes place where he captains a ship. Even though he has no qualifications and has never steered a dinghy before, but he's elected to lead this ship and steer it through rough waters. And the people that he looks up to are the bloodthirsty pirates who see him as a joke and a lapdog. And so, yeah, some of the corollaries are a little obvious there, like the pale one and blood.
I think we've lost Dave Eggers in full flow. We apologize for that. Read The Captain and the Glory. It is quite an amazing satire. Now, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and as we've reported, this cruelty has surged around the world along with the pandemic due to mandatory lockdowns with abuser and victim trapped inside together. Our next guest knows firsthand the devastating impact of violence in the home. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Natasha Threlwell was 19 when her stepfather murdered her mother. This excruciating pain is the subject of her new book, Memorial Drive, A Daughter's Memoir. She also writes about growing up in the 60s in the Deep South as a mixed-race child. And here she is in a raw and often emotional conversation with our Michelle Martin.
Thanks, Christian. Natasha Trethewey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I think many people are familiar with your work. You've won multiple awards. You're a respected, highly sought after college professor, teacher, former poet laureate of the United States, a high honor. I feel comfortable in saying that I'm sure millions of people know your work. And I remember reading a brief biography of you. It said her father, Eric Trethewey, was a poet. Her mother died when she was in college. Mm-hmm. Her mother died when she was in college. So just to get to the core terrible details, your stepfather, your mother's ex-husband, who had physically abused her and, frankly, if I may say, emotionally abused you, killed her when you were only 19 years old and when she was 40. She had finally gotten free of him. And frankly, he seems to have been threatening her for years, for what I can see. Why this book now? Did this book sort of force its way out of you? Why this book and why now?
I think it did. You know, I've been carrying this grief with me now for 35 years. And more, my mother was being erased. This erasure was ongoing. It was particularly easy for people, as I said, to draw this line straight through my father to me, because my father was a poet. My father was also my white parent. So there was something both racialized and patriarchal in this assumption that I'm who I am because of my father. And it wounded me deeply that people didn't understand that the thing that hurt me into poetry, that the thing that I had tried to contend with my whole adult life, was the loss of my mother. I felt like I needed to tell that story and to place who she was and what she meant to me in its proper perspective.
The title of your book, of course, is Memorial Drive, and it comes at this remarkable moment of reckoning for the country, where this country is reckoning with its racial past, as it does periodically. And one of the remarkable things about your book is the way it intertwines your personal history with that of the history of the South and of the country. So to that end, I just wanted to ask if you would mind reading a passage for us from the book.
Oh, of course, I'd be happy to. Mm-hmm. This is from the first chapter, which is called Another Country. In the spring of 1966, when I was born, my mother was a couple of months shy of her 22nd birthday. My father was out of town traveling for work, so she made the short trip from my grandmother's house to Gulfport Memorial Hospital as planned, without him. On her way to the segregated ward, she could not help but take in the tenor of the day. Witnessing the barrage of rebel flags lining the streets, private citizens, lawmakers, Klansmen, often one and the same, raising them in Gulfport and small towns all across Mississippi. She could not have missed the paradox of my birth on that particular day, a child of miscegenation, an interracial marriage still illegal in Mississippi and as many as 20 other states. Sequestered on the colored floor, my mother knew the country was changing, but slowly. She had come of age in the summer of 1965, turning 21 in the wake of Bloody Sunday, the Watts riots, and years of racially motivated murders in Mississippi. Unlike my father, who'd grown up a white boy in rural Nova Scotia, hunting and fishing, free to roam the open woods, my mother had come into being a black girl in the Deep South, hemmed in, bound to a world circumscribed by Jim Crow. Though my father believed in the idea of living dangerously, the necessity of taking risks, my mother had witnessed the necessity of dissembling, the art of making of one's face an inscrutable mask before whites who expected of blacks a servile deference.
It's always tricky asking an artist how she makes her art, but I am wondering how you arrived at this voice, how you arrived at this kind of intertwining of the personal with the social story, mm-hmm. You know, the mixing of the races, the expectation of white supremacy, expectation of deference. Was it hard?
Well, you know, it took a long time to write this book. It took me 7 years to write the book. And I think part of the hardest thing was to figure out the voice. Who am I in telling this story? And what is the story that needs to be told? I mean, because they're obviously the tragic facts of my mother's life and mine, but that's not the story. And what I realized, and it has everything to do with that intersection of public history, the history of the Civil War and the aftermath and the monuments we've erected to remember or misremember the Civil War, and my mother's death at the base of Stone Mountain, that largest monument to the Confederacy. Those things converge, and they actually represent my two existential wounds. You know, in his memorial to William Butler Yeats, W.H. Auden wrote, "Mad Ireland hurt you into poetry." Mm-hmm. Well, likewise, my nation, my native land, my South, my Mississippi, with its history of violence and racial oppression, inflicted my first wound. Being born there on Confederate Memorial Day was as if I were given that history to write. And then when my mother's death occurred at the base of that mountain, I could see how what is remembered and what is not was the very threshold through which to enter this book.
This book is so beautifully written, and yet it is so, if you don't mind my saying, it is so terrible in other ways. Just the recitation of the abuse that was visited upon your mother is very hard to read. It's obviously the remembering and the intuiting of the kind of physical harm that he's inflicting on your mother, but it's also terrifying and horrible to read the harm he inflicted on you in trying to silence you. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's this one passage where you come home and you say, "I'm going to be a writer."
Right.
And he says to you, "You're not going to do any of that."
Right.
I can't think of a more terrible thing to say to a child.
Yes. I mean, I think that anything that seemed like a dream that I had, he was going to try to find a way to shut that down. And that is a very telling moment in my relationship with my mother as well, because she was, you know, obviously enduring physical abuse at his hands, often out of sight, but something I could hear. And for years, in order to kind of do a kind of dissembling and to keep him from going into a violent rage later on out of sight, she would only talk to me about my accomplishments or achievements when he wasn't around. It was something that we had to keep secret. But that particular day, I came home so excited, I couldn't wait. And I said that at the dinner table. And when he said, "You're not going to do any of that," I could see my mother's hand clench the fork she was holding and her jaw clench. And she said, "She will do whatever she wants." And even in that moment, I knew the price that she was going to pay for defending me. And as much as she was, you know, willing to do that and knowing the cost, she wasn't going to let him batter my soul in the same way that he was battering hers.
Mm-hmm. Your stepfather murdered your mother. He murdered her after she had left him after a long history of abuse.
That's right.
That's the foundational fact. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. She'd been divorced from him for nearly 2 years when he murdered her. So she indeed had done everything right and gotten away, and he continued to stalk her. He even went to prison for attempting, well, he wasn't convicted of attempted murder, but he did try to kill her once before on Valentine's Day in 1984. He went to prison for about a year, but only convicted of criminal trespass. And when he got out, he came back and finished what he started.
Natasha, it's another hard thing, but it's my understanding that he's actually been released from prison now. Is that true?
That's right. He was released in March of last year.
May I ask, do you feel safe from him?
You know, the day that I found out, I had the strangest sensation of being inside my mother's body. And I was very afraid, and I felt very unsafe. I think the only thing that makes me feel safe, or a modicum of safety, is that I don't live in Atlanta anymore. I got out of Atlanta just before he was released, a year or two before. And so that helps. The distance helps. But I think I've never truly felt safe in the world.
Cassie Lehman writes in the New York Times that Trethewey's memoir is not the hardest book I have ever read. He says the poetry holding the prose together, the innovativeness of the composition, makes such a claim impossible. Memorial Drive is the hardest book I could imagine writing. And truly, you do some very difficult things in this book. I mean, you go through the files, like you're the police officer, incredibly, you encounter the police officer who responded to your mother's murder, and he retrieves the files for you.
Right.
And you go through them all. I just find myself wondering how you were able to do that, to read, you know, the fact that she was keeping notes of what was happening to her, create some sort of protection from her, for herself, which ultimately did not succeed. But how did you do that? And why did you feel that was so necessary to do?
Well, I resisted doing it for a long time. He gave me those files in 2005, and I did not allow myself to sit and go through them until I was in the process of writing this book. I didn't want to have to look at those things. I'd been trying to, I think, forget and avoid as much as I could, you know, over these last, 3 decades. And finally, when I did sit down, it was as if I were reliving those days. They came all back to me, and the grief, even now, having done that, the grief feels much more immediate, as opposed to sort of the dullness of it that I've lived with, my whole adult life. But I think it was important because it allowed the possibility of my mother's voice to enter this book along with mine. And I knew that that was important because I could tell you how resilient and powerful and loving she was, or I could just let you see it for yourself. And I think when you read those documents that I include in the book, you see it for yourself. The evidence is incontrovertible.
I'm reminded that as we are speaking now, this country along with many, many others, many people are still in lockdown mode. I mean, many people are trapped at home. I can't help but think about other people who might be trapped in similar circumstances as part of this effort to control this health crisis. But part of it makes me worry that another crisis is afoot. And I wonder if you think about that too, given what you saw, given what you grew up with.
I do. And it's a terrifying moment to think about how many people might be in a situation of domestic violence. One of the things that I think about all the time is that in the language of organizations committed to ending domestic violence, my mother was referred to as a perfect victim. Mm. And that's because not only did she do everything right, did she seek out the right resources to get out of this marriage, but she was also an educated professional woman who was not dependent upon her abuser for shelter, for the care of her children, for support, for financial support. And so if you have someone like my mother, like that, who can't even get away, what can you say to women who are in that situation but are dependent on their abusers for support. It's almost impossible to get away. And if you add to that, that the chances of you dying go up, not when you stay, but when you leave, it makes it almost impossible. And we are in a moment where all of that is the case now, and it's even harder to leave because where will people go during this time of lockdown?
This country is very, you know, fractured and traumatized right now, I feel comfortable in saying. Is there something we can learn from your story, do you think, as a country?
Oh, well, I would hope a lot of things, actually. You know, one of the things that I deal with constantly is the idea of memory and forgetting. On a personal level, you know, one might argue that for a long time, I enacted a kind of forgetting, thinking that that was helping me some kind of way. And yet, even as I was consciously trying to forget, I think our bodies recall trauma. So it was still there with me, waiting to somehow attack me at a different point. I think that's a metaphor for our kind of cultural amnesia in this country, that wounds that we haven't healed, that we've simply allowed to fester, are waiting to make us sick, to make us even more damaged, because we haven't contended with the truth of our shared history. I think that that's what this moment of reckoning is about. So I always, you know, Yeats wrote, "We make of the quarrel with others rhetoric, but of the quarrel with ourselves poetry." I always begin with the argument, the quarrel I have with myself, in order to talk about the larger quarrel that I have with my nation over our historical amnesia about race, about the aftermath of the Civil War, about the causes of the Civil War, about the reason that we erected monuments to the Confederacy. All of those things, if we don't deal with the truth of them, they're going to continue to erode us as a nation.
Natasha Trautman, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Michelle.
It's really sad, and of course, it's such an important reminder that we also need to address our national wounds. So we've got Dave Eggers back with us now, and I want to ask him kind of a postscript, really, to the book and to the conversation we were having. Perhaps what Michelle just asked Natasha, is there something from your story, completely different story, obviously, a satire of a captain who's taken charge of a ship, an incompetent, who throws, you know, all the manuals and all the norms out the window. Is there something from that that we can learn about our country, our world? Do you think about that now, you know, a year after that book was published?
I think we have to take ourselves seriously again as a country. And I think it starts at the educational level. I think that there's a maxim in this country that says anybody can grow up and become president. But I don't think we understand exactly what that means. It doesn't mean that anybody that has built golf courses and assigned his name to stakes can then govern a nation of 330 million. I think we have got to get back to respecting expertise, competence, and a respect for the work of governing. And until we do that, we're going to keep spiraling into a laughingstock.
So it's really interesting because the end, as you said, is vaguely optimistic. The captain escapes and the workers on board the ship pull together to try to restore the glory, as it's called, to its former working self. So I just want to read this to you. It's an excerpt. "This additional part of life on the glory, though horrifying and against every belief system and moral code ever devised by humans, was new, and anything new was something different, and different was inherently good." Again, does that remind you of anything? You talk about the captain, you talk about his supporters as his enthusiastic enablers, and you talk about his opposition as basically, you know, the kindly mutineers, but incompetence. How do you see that, you know, the dynamic playing out in the United States right now ahead of this election?
I think that his supporters, and I noticed this going to Trump rallies while he was a candidate, were really in corruption for his own sake. And they had a sort of gleeful attitude toward the prank, almost, of electing a clearly unqualified outsider with no respect for the nation's history, constitution, or rule of law. They thought, as we did in high school, when you elect the least electable and least qualified person to be your student council president, wouldn't it be funny if? And I think that Trump was the most surprised to be elected, but his supporters were also shocked. And I think that it goes to just a lack of seriousness among the electorate of the job of president and the dignity of the White House. And I think we can get back to it. It feels like we're trending that way. And I really do. I'm always optimistic. I do think that we can restore a sort of sense of self-esteem and self-seriousness, and we can be a dignified nation again and not sort of a reality show. I think that the fever will probably break. I think it's breaking right now. Jeff Flake, when he was opposing Trump, he said that the nation's caught in this fever, especially the GOP. Mm-hmm. And I think that that mm-hmm. fever is starting to break, and they're starting to leave Trump. But I don't know. I didn't think even it was remotely possible that he would be elected in 2016, so I'm cautiously optimistic. But I do think that we need to start at the educational level and remind ourselves what it means to govern and how serious that task is. And it should not be entrusted to any loudmouth or somebody who promises to disrupt for its own sake, to shake things up just to see what will happen.
Dave Eggers, author of The Captain and the Glory, thank you very much. And of course, education, education, education. Every parent tells you that. And finally, the pandemic has also forced many of us to put our dreams on hold, but it hasn't stopped this tourist, stranded in Peru for nearly 7 months because of coronavirus restrictions. Jesse Katayama from Japan finally got his wish to visit Machu Picchu, and he was the only visitor there. That is probably the first and last time that'll happen. He scaled this challenging height with the blessing of Peru's culture minister, capturing these spectacular views at the peak of what is an ancient Inca citadel designated a World Heritage Site. It's expected to open to the public again next month. Talking of Machu Picchu and other amazing destinations, join us later this week for a conversation with Michael Palin, who, of course, morphed from his cult comedy status with Monty Python to indispensable global travel guide in his series Around the World in 80 Days. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching. And now we return to CNN's continuing coverage of the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Amy Coney Barrett. Goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.